Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Friday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. You know, we begin our show every day with the powerful testimony of Lieutenant Colonel Vindman. Not only did he testify during the impeachment hearing, but he was not exactly perp walked, but he and his brother were escorted out of the White House in February because, in fact, he spoke truth to power. Something that we learn in this administration, the operative word is you don't speak truth and you clearly don't address the power. So now the powerful testimony of Lieutenant Colonel Vindman during the impeachment hearings of 2019.
Next month will mark 40 years since my family arrived in the United States as refugees. When my father was 47 years old, he left behind his entire life and the only home he had ever known to start over in the United States so his three sons could have a better and safer lives. His courageous decision inspired a deep sense of gratitude in my brothers and myself and instilled in us a sense of duty and service. All three of us have served or are currently serving in the military. My little brother sits behind me here today. Our collective military service is a special part of our family's history, a story in America. I'm grateful to my father's brave act of hope 40 years ago and for the privilege of being an American citizen and public servant, where I can live free and free of fear for mine and my family's safety. Dad, I'm sitting here today in the U.S. Capitol talking to our elected professionals is proof that you made the right decision 40 years ago to leave the Soviet Union and come here to the United States of America in search of a better life for our family. Do not worry. I will be fine for telling the truth. Thank you again for your consideration. I'll be happy to answer your questions.
If it's Friday, it must be Texas. And if it must be Texas, it must be the editor of the Quorum Report, the dean of the Austin Press Corps, the voice of Texas, Scott Braddock. You have no idea how often I talk about Texas now during the rest of the week. You have infected every conversation I have ever had in a good way, because I get to marbleize the Texas experience as we talk about things from energy, from governing, from how they're responding to COVID, to voting. Right. So thank you for the education. And I think it's important because Texas is such an important state, not only because of what it does economically and its size, but because of what it may mean in the next election of November of 2020. So given
For better or worse, Arnie, so often we lead the country. And I do like to say, so you know, sometimes Texas can be like a fungus. We will grow on you.
Anyway, well,
it certainly has been true.
Now that you said that and I did that, I want to start with something a little more interesting. In a way, it's not where most people would start, but knowing you, it's where I want to start.
Okay.
You sent me the following topic. A GOP Texas House candidate says coronavirus was sent by God to prevent kids in Austin public schools from learning about gender identity.
I had a feeling you would be interested in this, Arnie.
Focus.
Sign of the times that the campaigns, after months of being locked down, look, they have been on lockdown just as much as businesses and just people in their homes in general, trying to figure out how they're going to interact with the outside world during a global pandemic. Do people who are at home right now, do they want people to show up and knock on their doors and talk to them about politics? Do they really want organizers coming by the house? Do they want candidates to come by and give them their push card? And the case is really, for most people, no is the answer. One candidate who is block walking right now, and I always remind people, when you're talking about a legislative race, a state legislative race, and you know this as well as anybody, it's a local race. Even though it's a state office, it's for a local community's representative in Austin. And so it's not the kind of race that you can win by just running TV commercials, radio commercials, and internet stuff. You need to go out into the community.
It's intimate.
It's intimate. We always say, if you're blocking, then we can be talking, right? Because if you're getting out into the community, if you're in the neighborhoods, you're talking to people, and not just the people who necessarily agree with you, people who haven't even heard of you and need to learn about you, and you need to learn about them, right? The question I always ask.
Can I do a little sidebar here? Because having been a state representative, having been the first Democrat to represent a district that had been Republican in perpetuity, okay?
All right.
So under and remember, I am a liberal Democrat. So to go from Republicans to Arnie was kind of a shift. But I want people to understand the idea of the intimacy. We bought an old 1838 farmhouse on Route 10 in Orford, New Hampshire. Okay. The house had been falling apart. People saw me working incredibly hard, painting it, repairing it, planting flowers with it, doing 90% of the work myself, literally maintaining. And they saw a work ethic that they respected.
People like that.
They watched me climbing ladders.
Like that.
You know? And so one of the reasons why I asked someone, why did you vote for me? They said, because you care about us. By repairing that house, by inviting us in, by doing these things, we got a sense of your values. I said, well, you really, do you want all my political ideas are? They said, we know you're different from us, Arnie, but we also know that there are things that are important to us that you will respect and you will listen to. So that idea of that intimacy, I can't even tell you how important it is. Especially right. at that local legislative level. It isn't as much about the state as it is about them.
That's right. And that's why the legislative branch is the first branch of government. It's the branch that's closest to the people and is the most accountable to the people. That's why state representatives and members of Congress have to run for re-election every 2 years, because if they lose touch with those communities, the communities will stop sending them back. And that's why we get into these arguments about whether the voters should be picking the politicians or the other way around when they draw these districts, as we'll get into with redistricting next year. So I had talked to a couple of candidates who are Republicans who are running for state house in Western Travis County, right here in the Austin area. There are runoffs that are coming up on July 14th. We had, of course, the March primary, and we do all of our stuff at the same time. The state representatives and the state senators and governor and everybody, if they're on the ballot, that year, actually governor and lieutenant governor. This is one incumbent protection program that people don't know about, Arnie. Governor, lieutenant governor, the statewide candidates, they don't run in presidential years in Texas. They run in the off years. So it's in the lower turnout elections where they run. But for other statewide office holders like John Cornyn, he was on the ballot as well in March. And now anyone who has a runoff, you know, from that March primary now has to be campaigning in some kind of a way, and they're figuring out how to do that. How the candidates are doing it is interesting. One of the candidates in this particular race has chosen to start block walking again as of Mother's Day weekend. This woman named Jennifer Fleck has been out once again. She told me that on a recent weekend when they knocked about 600 doors in the district, only about 10 to 15 people actually sort of came out to the door and really wanted to engage in a conversation. Otherwise, you know, either people didn't answer the door or they might have just listened through the screen door, you know, and then said, hey, you can leave your flyer on my porch. But you're talking to a lot of people who are 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 time Republican primary voters. Generally in these runoffs, what the candidates want to do is target those voters who aren't just people who voted in the original round, in the first round of the race, but they also want to talk to those dedicated Republicans, or if it's a Democratic primary, the other way around, the dedicated Democrats, the ones who are the most likely to vote in a July 14th runoff.
And they tend to be the most extreme. Let's also be honest here, because that's what happens. If they're that devoted, they tend to have an agenda, and their agenda tends to be the more liberal if it's a Democrat, or more conservative and radical if it's a Republican.
And there is a correlation between the way these folks are running and their ideology. The person, this woman who is block walking and says that kind of direct voter contact, that traditional way of doing it, even during a pandemic, that woman is the one who thinks that coronavirus was sent to the world if for one of the reasons that she gave, that she thought that it was sent by God, is to keep students in the Austin Independent School District from learning about something called you'll love this, Arnie, the gingerbread man. The Austin ISD was getting ready to do some gender identity education for kids in elementary, I think, and in middle school as well. And they had this graphic, this visual aid called the gingerbread man. The gingerbread person, because the gingerbread individual is not gendered. And to teach these kids about this. Well, she, Jennifer Fleck, this candidate, thinks that, and she's genuine in her belief, as far as I can tell, she thinks that that is a perversion, that's gender confusion, and we can get into all of that.
But she is connecting it to the pandemic. That's what makes it so toxic. It's not that she believed that.
Well,
it's that she somehow next then?
Well, when she was organizing Republicans and conservatives against this lesson plan that was going to be rolled out in the Austin School District, she got the sense that the school district wasn't listening. They were going to go ahead and do this. She was calling it evil. But when the pandemic hit and they closed all the schools, and therefore this lesson could not be taught, she wrote on her Facebook page that it was an answer to her prayers, and that God stepped in here. It was divine intervention. Some of her own friends on Facebook and followers on Facebook were cussing at her and saying, "Are you blanking serious? You can't really believe that this virus was sent to stop this." She said that God did something good, that God kept, you know, the kids out of school via this pandemic to keep them from learning about this. This candidate is very focused on social issues and on sex education in particular. Basically, her entire involvement in politics, both politics generally and the legislature specifically, has to do with her experience in a couple of school districts.
She doesn't care about life because if the pandemic is something that she sees the benefit so that these kids won't learn this, she's obviously made the decision that the people that are dying in Texas, they're actually expendable in order that these kids don't learn about this.
The candidate who is not block walking is an Austin police officer named Justin Berry. And the police officer, without swiping at her directly, it's interesting that in this race, the two candidates have not gotten nasty with each other just yet. And that was the case in the first round of the voting. That's what happens in the state level races when there's lots of candidates. I think there were five candidates in this race originally. Usually they don't attack each other and go after each other just yet. That will probably change before July 14th when the runoff happens. But the Austin police officer has an eye toward infrastructure and talking about investment in public and transportation and public education, things like that. Without swiping at her directly, Barry did say that we need a representative for this area who isn't just focused on one issue. And let me widen the aperture here a little bit, Arnie, and pull back and talk about why this is more important in the grand scheme. So you have the Democrats in Texas within 9 votes of taking the majority in the Texas House of Representatives. Right now, the district that we're talking about is represented by a freshman Democrat, one of the Democrats who won a seat, took one from a Republican in 2018. And you remember 2018 was a pretty good year for Democrats in Texas. Of course, generationally, it's a little difficult because you have all these young Democrats who have never actually seen a statewide candidate win here in Texas. And so their frame of reference for a winning campaign is one that they still lost to Ted Cruz, you know, just barely. Right. So you have the possibility of Democrats taking the majority. This is a district where Republicans have said, Arnie, they're not just going to try to defend the seats that they have. They want to take some of those seats back that they lost in 2018. And there are some numbers that work. This is a district that's sort of close. This is a pretty close win for the Democrat. But there are at least 3 others that I would say, you know, put at least 4 seats in play for Republicans to potentially take back. That would widen the margin, right, for Republicans in the battle to try to hold their majority in the Texas House. And here's something that I think is, I'm trying to figure out whether it's good or bad. I think it's certainly different that these Texas House races are potentially going to become even more expensive with Republicans spending a lot more money and Democrats saying that they're also going to pour a lot more money into these races. But they're not so much about the individual communities anymore. For those different groups that want to influence the outcome of this election, they're more interested in taking the majority in Austin. If the Democrats can elect a Texas House Speaker for the first time since 2003, if that happens, then we will suddenly have a more balanced government in Austin. We would have a Democratic House of Representatives. You would still have, in all likelihood, still have a Republican Texas Senate and a Republican governor, and they'd all have to figure out how to deal with each other next year when we have a huge budget shortfall because of the slowdown in the economy, because of the coronavirus pandemic. And then we would also have to figure out how redistricting is going to go, which is the most partisan exercise there is. And to have Republicans not be completely in control of that would mean a lot for the next decade as far as the politics and the policies.
And remember, this is also the census time. This is when you start determining the size of districts. So the idea of them being able to take over the House is actually more crucial now than ever.
So come back to this specific race in Travis County, and this would apply to the other races around the state as well. For the Republicans, I think the big money donors would much rather see a more pragmatic candidate going into November to go up
against the Democrat. Exactly.
And if it's the candidate who thinks that, you know, God sent the pandemic for any reason, that's probably not going to go well in November, although Republican primary voters do have a tendency around here to choose the candidate who's a little more extreme.
Okay, so I'm going to be a little wonky here.
Go
when you go into these primary votes, and then this is the runoff, can anyone vote in that primary?
No. When you go into the runoff, it has to be people who voted in the Republican primary, or if it's a Democratic runoff, it has to be somebody who voted in the Democratic primary.
That's not true initially. And it's not partisan.
In Texas,
you can pick up either one, right?
That's right. In Texas, if you, in the first round of the primary, I suspect there were some Republicans who voted in the presidential primary on the Democratic side in Texas. I don't know how many, but I had heard, you know, just anecdotally that some people would. You might remember back in 2008, Rush Limbaugh and a lot of the conservative thought leaders were telling Republicans to vote in the Texas Democratic primary. At that time, John McCain had already sewn up the Republican nomination, and Limbaugh was calling it Operation Chaos. He thought that there should be a continued protracted war between Senator Obama and Senator Clinton. And he wanted to keep that going. And part of the idea was to, you know, sort of muddy the waters in the Texas primary. I don't know how much that probably had some marginal effect. I think that there was enough excitement in that year for there to be a significant Democratic turnout. And, you know, prior to that, there had not been huge numbers of people voting in Democratic primaries in Texas. There were about 3 million people who voted in that primary in 2008. But in the meantime, it was my suspicion and the suspicion of other people that the Democratic Party around here, you know, they had that voter list.
Yep.
From the 3 million who voted, and they wadded it up and threw it in the trash because I couldn't see any evidence that they ever used it for anything after that.
Okay, so a couple things. One, remind everyone that we're Zooming on Thursday in order to air the show on Friday, and Scott is speaking, I think, outside, so I'm just kind of curious what bird I'm hearing in the background. So as people
there's all
hear
sorts
this
of birds.
Noise,
I thought I would talk to you out on the porch this morning in Austin, but you know, but let me tell you something, Arnie.
Yeah.
We are back to the days in Texas where it goes from being pretty nice out to 100 degrees every day for the rest of the year. So I'm going to enjoy it while I can.
So I'm kind of curious, are you noticing a change in the environment? I mean, I'm seeing things where people are, my daughter lives in China and they're seeing blue sky for the first time ever. No one's walking around with a mask because of the pollution, because there's such a cut in pollution. People are seeing the return of, you know, animals that they've never seen before. Is there anything visible in Austin that you're seeing, or was Austin sort of exempt from some of the pollution problems that might have been experienced by places like in Houston and everywhere else?
Haven't noticed it as much in Travis County and Austin, the central Texas area. I can tell you that in Houston, they have not seen as much of a drop in air pollution as they've seen in places like Los Angeles, for example. You may have seen the pictures out of Southern California where there's no smog in LA because there's no cars and no big trucks on the roads as well, at least not as many of them. Although that's been picking back up as they've had to, you know, ship things for people to be able to get stuff delivered at home. But in Houston, you got to remember it's a huge petrochemical corridor. And so a lot of that manufacturing still going on along the Houston Ship Channel. And even though oil prices are down, I think we're back up around 30, at least we had been earlier in the week. As we talk here on Thursday morning, you mentioned we tape on Thursdays, we're at $34 a barrel for oil. So that's actually a positive sign for the Texas economy.
Well, remember when it was negative. I want people to understand it went negative
within the last couple of weeks. It had gone negative, which is just a horrible thing for the Texas economy. Of course, most of the places that you would do a news story about gas prices being so low, I'm sure in New Hampshire, that's always a positive news story usually. Although nothing seems to be, there aren't many stories that seem to be positive.
Well, if you're not driving, who cares?
But it's a double-edged sword in Houston, and specifically and generally in Texas, because we are very reliant on the energy industry for our economy.
I do want to talk a little bit about voting because there's a huge issue, and I actually saw, was it Paxton on MSNBC? I think so. I was like, ooh. I was sort of surprised to see who I was seeing. So we know that there are issues. And once again, in defense of Texas, they have expanded the opportunity to do early voting by, I believe, about 10 days. We've talked about early voting. There is this fight about whether you should have any kind of in-person voting on election day, that mail-in voting might be better. But obviously, they're reducing the pressure on election day by expanding the number of days where you could actually, you know, do early voting. But early voting still requires you to physically show up. Am I correct?
Yeah. That's right. Early voting in Texas.
The whole issue is not about mail-in versus showing up. It's about even when you're expanding it and you're trying to lighten the pressure, people are still being asked to run the risk of going in to vote. People are still running the risk of collecting those votes because that's what the workers do when they are at the polling places. So that really is the issue. No matter how much you expand it, why should people physically have to show up?
There are several lawsuits playing out on multiple levels here in Texas on this issue of mail-in ballots, and it is conventional wisdom in this state, even though in a lot of other places, Arnie, I have just learned recently, I didn't know because I was just doing some research, in other places you can basically ask for a mail ballot and you get it without having to provide much reason as to why you want to do that. In Texas, it's pretty restricted. Those who are 65 and older automatically qualify for a mail-in ballot if they want it. They can vote in person if they want to, but if they ask for one, no question, if they're over 65, they get it. That, of course, generally benefits Republicans. It's conventional wisdom around here that expansion of the franchise is better for Democrats and restrictions on it is better for Republicans.
Donald Trump has actually told us that.
Well, he just said it all. He always says the quiet part out loud.
Exactly.
He says the quiet part out loud, which is, in some ways, that's refreshing. You know, he said you can't have...
It's confirming for me. It's what I know, and now I know I'm absolutely right.
Well, he says no mail-in ballots, even though he votes by mail in Florida, personally votes by mail in Florida. You can also qualify for a mail-in ballot if you're under 65, but you have some sort of physical disability. And this is where the legal cases come into play. And there are a couple of things that are playing out. The state courts, it's like we're bouncing between the guardrails, Arnie. The state courts have gone back and forth about whether people should be able to vote by mail in an expanded way this time around for both the July 14th runoff that I mentioned and for the general election. The Texas Supreme Court, the highest civil court in Texas, heard the case yesterday, on Wednesday, as we talk here on Thursday. They'll make their decision at the state level. A federal court in San Antonio ruled this week that the mail ballot should be expanded. A judge down there, Fred Beery, who I was reminded ran for Texas Supreme Court decades ago. He was supposed to be, he was the favored Democratic candidate at the time. Karl Rove and some others had recruited someone you might have heard of to run for the Texas Supreme Court at that same time. His name is John Cornyn. Senator John Cornyn, who ended up winning. Ended up winning that race. The trial lawyers in Texas had recruited Beery years ago, the guy who's now the federal judge in San Antonio, and the tort reformers, Texas Medical Association, and others had recruited Cornyn to run for Supreme Court. He went on to be Attorney General and then the United States Senator, our U.S. Senator. Beery, in the case in San Antonio, said that out of millions of votes cast over many years in Texas, only 73, not 7,300, not 730, only 73 cases have been prosecuted of voter fraud in this state. And so the judge said, it's just not the case that this is some widespread problem. But you can guess what happened right after that. After he made that ruling, the Fifth Circuit in New Orleans, which we're under in Texas, we're in the Fifth Circuit, very conservative court, of course, they reversed the judge's order. And so there's a lot of confusion right now, Arnie, about whether people can vote by mail in Texas. So let me cut past that and get to the bigger picture. On this argument of whether or not under the statute, you are disabled because you may think you might get COVID-19 by going to the polling place. And let's think about what kind of environment that is. You could stand in line for hours on election day. This is a presidential election year. There's going to be a high turnout. That's what we expect. Even during early voting, a lot of times in these elections, there can be long lines. And then people are just physically touching the same machine over and over and over. If the person before you, the three people before you, or the person who was five people in front of you in line had COVID-19, but maybe they're asymptomatic, they touched the machine, then you come and touch it, and guess what? Now you've got it because you went down. Now, being afraid of catching the disease, Arnie, is not a disability, right? You might be.
It is in New Hampshire. It's not in Texas. Just to let you know, in New Hampshire, our Republican governor said fear of contracting COVID is a disability for the purposes of absentee balloting, i.e. mail-in balloting. In Texas, the opposite is true. So I just have one other question for you. Because if I fear this, and they're saying it's not a disability in Texas, is there going to be a requirement that everyone must be masked in order to vote?
No. So, but let me come back to the law for just a second. I talked to a longtime Republican attorney, somebody who handles election contests, things like that, has done it for years, who told me privately that by the plain statute of the law, we shouldn't be talking about fear and whether you are afraid of going to the polling place. There are neighborhoods in Texas where I'm sad to say that you might fear getting shot but going to the polling place, right? But that doesn't qualify you for a mail-in ballot. However, the statute says disability. And what this Republican lawyer said to me was, if you lack immunity to a disease that is ravaging the world, that should qualify as a disability under the state statute. And this attorney was saying, he said, this was his quote to me. He says, I don't know how the attorney general wins this case just based on what the law says. You should be considered disabled if you lack immunity. Now let's think about that for a second. We don't even know based on the science so far, whether having the disease even gives you long-term antibodies to not get it again. We don't even know that. I had a friend who told me that they had a friend who had tested positive for COVID-19 about a month ago. They recovered from it. Then they got the antibody test, and the antibody test did not show antibodies. Why would that be? It could either be that the test was wrong, or it could be that they just didn't develop an immunity to it. So in the meantime, we're trying to figure out where all this is going, Arnie. And I know you got to go in just a second here, but let me just say this. What we're probably really setting up for here is a situation. Remember, there are 254 counties in Texas, about 29 million people across two time zones. There's no way for the attorney general of the state to police what every single elections administrator is going to do. When you ask for a mail-in ballot, they're not going to go check that. They can't do that. But what they do want to do is, through this court action, set up a backstop, because this is going to be a very competitive year in Texas. Democrats are hoping to beat John Cornyn. They're hoping to maybe take a seat or two on the Texas Supreme Court, which is making the decision about whether you have to go down there to the polling place or mail in a ballot. And if a Democrat barely wins in November, if that happens,
then they have a place to challenge.
If lightning strikes, get ready for this. I'm not predicting it, but don't be surprised if it happens. If a Democrat punches through anywhere on the ballot in Texas at the statewide level, and maybe in some of these legislative races too, where it could potentially put the House in the Texas House in the hands of the Democratic Party, you would see challenges everywhere. The Attorney General and others, and Governor Abbott and others, will probably say, we need to take a look at all these mail-in ballots and make sure they were all legit.
Right. Well, I'm going to be curious if they're going to require people to show up. Are they going to require them to be masked? Because this is not just, of course not.
No chance.
That's why, I mean, I just want everyone to know, it's kind of like contagion is us.
No mask, no gloves, none of that. It's called freedom, Arnie, it's called freedom. Get with the program.
I know, get with the program. I am getting with the program, and I have to say au revoir to you, Scott Braddock. Thank you so much. Scott Braddock is the editor of the Quorum Report, the voice of Texas, the dean of the Austin Press Corps. If it's Friday, it must be Scott. All right, everyone, stick around. A little current cast is next. And then we go to the great state of Iowa to chat with Stefan Schmidt. Talk to you in a bit.
Using gravity to predict floods. It's a weighty topic on this current cast. NASA satellites monitor changes in the Earth's gravity field. Yes, gravity changes. J.T. Rager of the NASA Jet Propulsion Laboratory says shifting water masses play a role.
If you have more water in a region, you have more mass there. And more mass is associated with more gravity, and therefore changes in water can cause changes in gravity.
So think of river basins as buckets. When they're almost full of snow, soil moisture, and groundwater, the NASA satellites will measure a small increase in gravity, alerting us that the system is saturated and more likely to flood with added precipitation. Rager says that by combining gravity measurements with weather forecasts, we could see floods coming about 5 months in advance. CurrentCast is produced in partnership with Cornell's Atkinson Center for a Sustainable Future. Learn more online at currentcast.org.
Baby's cry for their mother's wall. about anything. Some got it worse than me. Some got it worse than you. See the people starving underneath the tree. You wonder what happened to the golden roof. Face of the nation. It's changing and changing. The face of the nation. I don't recognize it no more. Face of the nation.
Part two of the Friday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. Every other Friday, we schlep to Iowa, actually Nevada, not Ames, to hang out with Stefan Schmidt. Stefan Schmidt is affectionately known as Dr. Politics. He's been teaching for decades at Iowa State. In fact, just to let you know, Stefan Schmidt, one of I don't know if she was one of your students, but Elaine Godfrey joined us from the Atlantic Monthly, and we had the most hilarious interview about socialism and all the people that are registering to be socialists now. I think there was a 10,000 person increase in just 1 month. It was very, very funny. And during the course of the interview, I said to her, wow, this is wonderful. I'm so glad that Stefan has sort of, you know, trained you so well. And at the end, she said, you know, he kept telling me I should talk to you. I said, well, now you know what you're missing. So on that note, there are a lot of stories out there. There's stories about Pompeo. There's stories about Flynn. There's stories about the election. There's stories about Donald Trump wanting to select certain doctors who will basically mirror his misinformation, whatever it is. But the story that absolutely made me apoplectic is this one. Okay, ready? And I'm going to read to you from my Facebook post because I want people to hear my outrage as I posted it. I wrote, this story makes me want to vomit. Trump is a complete and total bastard. Share with every National Guardsman you know and their family members. Here we go. In 2017, Donald Trump signed something called the Forever GI Bill at his company's golf course in Bedminster, New Jersey. The law expanded the educational benefits that had been made available under the post-9/11 GI Bill, which was passed in 2008, and which supplemented various benefits that could be traced back to the original 1944 GI Bill. The White House would later tout the Forever GI Bill as an example of how Trump was working tirelessly to provide the benefits and services that our veterans deserve. In late March, this is the kicker, everyone. In late March, the Trump administration authorized the deployment of members of the National Guard to help local authorities conduct coronavirus tests, set up field hospitals, and perform other critical public health tasks that carried a risk of infection. More than 40,000 service members have been deployed in total. But Politico now reports that they will all be recalled on June 24th. Remember the date, everyone. Why June 24th? Because it is one day before the first group sent into the field would have reached the 90-day active duty minimum that's required to qualify for GI Bill educational benefits and for retirement benefit that was created in 2008. So says the news site. The official is a FEMA staffer.
Unbelievable.
Oh God, Stefan, it is beyond unbelievable. I mean, the chutzpah, the day before the 90 days runs out. This guy is such an immoral sot.
Oh. But you know, the interesting thing is I haven't heard a single Democrat or the Democratic Party mention this story.
What is the
matter with them? Every day there are things that the Democrats ought to be responding to and not attacking Trump, because that doesn't work.
Exactly.
Instead, you know, talk about the story and say, geez, this is really awful. You know, I have a cousin who is in the National Guard and blah, 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 you know. But the Democrats are very silent. And
let me just say why, in part, this story made me crazy. So yesterday, the day before this interview, we interviewed a woman from the Carsey Institute at UNH. And we were talking about how to bring food to people who are now food insecure as a result of the pandemic. And one of the stories we were telling was the stories of food dumping. You know, that they're dumping potatoes, they're dumping milk, they're killing chickens, they're killing baby pigs because they can't deliver it to market because the food infrastructure has fallen apart. Yeah. A lot of it is because of what's happening with some of the meat packing facilities, but a lot of it is because restaurants aren't ordering their food anymore because schools aren't. So there's a different delivery system for them than there is for you and I who get it to our grocery store.
Right.
So I naively suggest to this woman from the Carsey Institute, I have an idea. You know who should be delivering this food to food banks and food pantries? The National Guard.
Mm-hmm.
I literally said this yesterday, okay? Mm-hmm. And I'm like, the National Guard is set up to do this.
That's right. What
they did in Afghanistan. It's what they do. You always see those trucks going by. Yep. They're logistic people. That is their area of expertise. Yeah. They're not good at shooting. They're good at logistics. I said, imagine if they went up to Maine. Imagine if they went to the dairy farms in New York. Imagine if they went to some of the chicken farms and they could deliver it directly to the food pantries.
Yeah.
She goes, wow, that's a brilliant idea, Arnie. I'm surprised you're not being used by this. And then I saw this story.
Mm.
And I emailed her immediately. And I went, oh my God, Jess. You know why no one's suggesting the National Guard?
Mm-hmm.
Because they don't want to use them, because they may have to actually deliver on the promise that Donald Trump made with that, you know, in perpetuity GI Bill. He doesn't want to deliver on anything because he wants to cut people off at the knees whenever it's convenient.
What's interesting is that at the same time as we're spending like a drunken sailor, right? I mean, the federal deficit is going up, the budget is exploding more than ever. There are also behind the scenes all these other places where we're actually cutting funding and reducing funding. And so, you know, it's sort of the worst of all combination of things, you know, and at the same time, the disease itself is still, I think, a big puzzle, because every day I'm reading, watching, and listening to contradictory stories. You know, now the CDC says, oh, you don't have to really wipe all the surfaces and stuff because that's not where people are catching it. And then I see an epidemiologist this morning interviewed, and he said, well, I'm wiping all my surfaces, all the doorknobs, all the handles, all the places where people are touching things, where I might go into the grocery store and touch something. He said, I'm not going to take the chance and say, no, you know, you don't have to worry about it spreading there, because we really don't know.
Well, one of the things the CDC is doing is it's benefiting employers, because what their employers are doing is they're going to point to whatever the CDC is saying. And if the CDC is constantly making you do less and less and less, that means they have to do less and less and less. And even if you contract COVID, they can say, oh, it's not our fault. We were following the CDC guidelines.
That's right. Exactly.
So please, everyone understand, this is being massaged.
And you can protect yourself from lawsuits.
Right. No, exactly. Yeah. They don't even need immunity. The CDC is providing them with lawsuit immunity by constantly eroding whatever we need to do. I mean, just the other day, there was an executive council meeting in New Hampshire. I just want people to hear this. The question is, should you be wearing masks?
No.
At the end of the interview I just did with Scott Braddock, I asked if they're going to require everyone to show up and vote or say that you can't claim COVID-19 as a disability. So whether you've expanded early voting, you still have to physically show up. Is there going to be a requirement that you wear a mask? So, yeah, and he said, oh, God, Arnie, live free and die and contract COVID. Well, the governor of New Hampshire yesterday at the executive council meeting was asked about mask wearing. Mm-hmm. And he said, well, my people are telling me that it really isn't necessary. But who are his people? Who are his people? The same doctors, I think, that Donald Trump is about to hire to put out his lies. The same doctors who are probably going to say, oh, yeah, you can put a little Clorox in your veins. The same doctors who are going to basically say, oh, yeah, you can insert light inside of you. The same doctors who are going to say, yeah, hydroxychloroquine, whatever it is, you know, of course you can take it, even if it kills you if you have a heart condition. I mean, this is so scary because now the governor of New Hampshire is actually suggesting he's talking to some experts who are saying that mask wearing doesn't help. And yet when you look at all the countries that have used masks vigorously, their number of infections have dropped dramatically. So we know there's a cause and effect, Stefan.
Oh yeah, the evidence is also empirically coming from epidemiologists and from studies that are now being completed, wrapped up, and reported, that masks are a terrific protection. The other thing, Arnie, is thank God you have large glasses that you wear. I have smaller ones, but I do have some aviator glasses because you can catch the coronavirus through your eyes. I mean, so, your eyes are, you know, your mask only covers your nose and your mouth. Your eyes are exposed.
Wait. Let me just say something. So the most important time to wear some kind of glasses is in a confined space. Yeah. And I don't mean even a grocery store. I mean like an airplane. Because as you heard that doctor who suggested that he probably got it, he was covered everywhere except for his eyes. So I had a friend who's going back to Singapore. Okay. Yeah. She's been here for a while. Yeah. So we were talking and she's going to be masked up and she's going to be wearing gloves. I said, wear aviator glasses.
That's right.
Wear sunglasses. She goes, what?
Go get ski masks. Go to the ski shop and get ski masks.
I said, there are two things I'm going to recommend. And I'm not a doctor, everyone. But I'm going to recommend don't get an aisle seat. Get a seat next to the window. Because the aisle seat is the seat where more and more people go back and forth than they might cough.
Yes.
I said, wear your mask. Do what you're supposed to do. But wear large sunglasses. First of all, you look beautiful in them, number one.
That's right. Exactly.
And number two, because it looks good. But especially in an airplane where you're so confined and there isn't the kind of circulation you need. That may not be true other places. Again, this is sort of geographically specific. Yeah. You need to be a certain way on the long trail, and you need to be a certain way when you're in an airplane. Sure. And I want people to understand that you have to be somewhat of an accordion. But to suggest that mask wearing, especially when you're going to be voting or whether you're going to be in a place where it's going to be, you know, a lot of other people around, even if you're social distancing, for the governor to say his people said it doesn't necessarily protect you, I want him to name his people.
Well, I'm wondering, why would he say that? Why wouldn't he say, well, you know, masks are a good idea, and if you don't want to wear one, you're taking a risk and you're exposing other people. You know, why just dismiss masks? Yeah. What is the political or other objective of that in Governor Sununu saying that? I mean, I don't understand it.
Well, but a lot of other governors are saying it, and you just heard from Scott Braddock that they're going to be saying, I mean, you know what Texas is going to be? Texas is going to be the Swedish model. What did the Swedes do? The Swedes have the highest level of death per capita of any country in Europe. The Swedes decided to basically do very little to nothing. Texas is kind of doing the same thing, very little to nothing. And it's going to be very, very interesting because the day that the governor opened up even more businesses, even though he hardly closed anything because he was intimidated by hairdressers, but the governor, it's true, you know it's true, but the governor of Texas is going to eat, the day he opened, the highest spike of deaths and people who contracted COVID was that same day. So obviously he's not looking at death, or he thinks death becomes us. You know, he thinks that this is
legitimate. Well, I mean, in Iowa, our governor has been interesting but disturbing because she has been slowly opening up counties and these districts that she's designed where the coronavirus incidents have declined. But overall, the number of cases and the number of deaths keeps going up every day. And yet she, today, on Friday, she's opening up, you know, all this, the beauty parlors, all restaurants, massage parlors, tattoo parlors, you know, all the places where, you know, contagion is more likely. And she's saying, you know, be careful and so on. But we'll have to see how that works. You know, Sweden is regretting what they're doing. Yes, I mean, they're rethinking it and saying, well, you know, our nursing homes are devastated. Nursing homes in Sweden are where all the cases are happening.
Right. But let's also remember there's a couple things here, too. Their idea was herd immunity. We're finding out that we might not have that immunity. There's a story coming out right now from China that they're seeing in the northeastern part of China a new form of disease. So it may be sort of mutating, which is something we have feared. Remember, this has only been around for a couple of months.
Yeah.
So the idea is it takes a couple of months for some kind of a mutation to occur. We're going to learn more because one of the first places it hit was China. So China has the longest experience. And if we're going to see mutation, it's going to be in China. So that story just came out. What does that mean for some kind of vaccine if it's mutating? You know, a vaccine only works with the coronavirus you're dealing with, not the mutated version that may show up in 2021. In addition, so you know what this tells me? This tells me two things, Stefan.
Yeah.
We don't have a vaccine for AIDS. We don't.
Yeah.
But what we do have for AIDS is a very vigorous treatment.
Yeah.
So vigorous now that you can actually now have sex and not give your AIDS to someone else.
Yep.
And that shows you that this treatment has been really quite remarkable.
Remarkable.
I suspect that what we are gonna have to spend a lot of time, as much as we wanna spend the time on the vaccine, is to figure out treatment.
Yeah.
Because if 99% of us will probably get it, but if we know that we can take a pill or we can reduce our stay or whatever, treatment is gonna be essential. And the other reason why treatment is going to be essential is that we're finding out that once you get COVID, you're not done with it. You may have liver damage. You may have lung damage. You may have all these other kinds of damages. So it leaves you with something that no other flu has ever left you with.
The other thing, Arnie, that, and I'm not sure, I send you so many articles, I apologize, but I read something just this morning. The number of Americans who are saying, I'm not going to take a vaccine if there is a vaccine, is huge and growing. And there were protests in New Hampshire of people who don't want to be vaccinated, who think that it is a plot. They think it's a plot between Trump and the pharmaceutical companies so they can make a lot of money on some vaccine that is going to be highly dangerous. So they're saying, even if there is a vaccine, I'm not going to get vaccinated. The other story is that children are not getting their regular vaccines that they should be getting for all of the childhood diseases, which if things break out there, it'll affect adults, it'll affect everyone. I mean, the whole culture of healthcare in this country is sort of crumbling to some extent. It's not growing and improving.
No. And look, we already had an eroded public healthcare system. Public health was the poor child. It went to the back of the bus. It lost funding. It didn't gain the respect that it needed. And now we're finding out how important public health is. But here's the other problem. If you haven't really seen a vigorous public health system and you don't really understand how important it is, you haven't developed the public health system muscle to respect it. Mm-hmm. So when something like this happens and all this misinformation is coming out, and a lot of the misinformation is coming out of the mouth of the president, your ability to respond from a public health perspective is being eroded. Because you haven't even had one in place for the longest time, and now your president basically trashes it. So, and I'm going to say something awful. This is awful, everyone, but I keep thinking it. We see that the huge number of people that die come from two categories. One are the very elderly. People keep saying, oh, but the elderly are the demographic that supports Donald Trump, not the nursing home elderly. Okay, they don't vote for the most part. And, you know, they're in their 80s and who knows how they're voting, but they're not a huge demographic that would be supporting Donald Trump. 67-year-olds, yes, but 88-year-olds, no. What we know is that those old people that are dying in droves, in hundreds of thousands, that eventually I suspect will happen, is that they're very expensive because they cost the Medicaid system a lot of money. And that's really what a lot of them are on. They're on Medicaid because, you know, their assets are completely gone. Medicare doesn't cover long-term care. And these, so Donald Trump sees this as a financial benefit.
Wow.
I mean, saving the government money because all those people will not be taxing our Medicaid system. Wait a minute. The other demographic, Blacks and Hispanics are dying in larger numbers, especially in urban areas. I think that's also part of his calculus. Those people will never vote for Donald Trump. Those people are probably Democrats. Those people are expendable. Because why? Because they're a demographic he doesn't want to see show up. And if voter suppression isn't effective, death is.
Whoa. But you know, the interesting thing is it's not going to work because the Latinos and African Americans in many cases are in big cities that vote overwhelmingly Democrat anyway, and a few of them dying. I mean, the numbers, you know, we're a country of 350 million people and 200 million voters. And, you know, 100,000 people dying isn't going to really change the voting equation in most places a whole hell of a lot. And plus, the other thing, Arnie, is that when you talked about seniors, you know, elderly people and so on, the new polls show that older Americans are abandoning Trump and not trusting him and saying he's not doing a good job. And that demographic might have voted for him.
That demographic has two problems right now. Not only do they see that somehow Trump thinks that they're expendable, because he's not being vigorous in the kind of things that they would need to see happen. In fact, he's threatening people to open up their economies sooner than a lot of older people think that they should be open. Okay, right. They're the ones that are the most lethargic at opening up the economy, in part because they're not employed. Okay, let's be honest here. They're not.
And they don't go to bars, and they don't go to big, huge music festivals where everybody is hugging and kissing and drinking a lot.
Right. But they're not excited about opening up the economy. Number one. Number two. They also think that what Donald Trump is doing, because he has been so harmful to the economy, is that a lot of them are looking at their investments. Mm. And they're seeing every month they're getting their thing from JP Morgan, or they're getting their thing from, you know, Vanguard, and they're noticing what was 100,000 is now 90,000. Yeah. What was 90,000 is now 85,000.
Right.
And, you know, the market isn't doing as badly as the rest of the economy, but it's still doing badly, and they don't have time to regroup.
Right.
So they see a guy who has created more debt. They've seen a guy who's lied about how to respond to this from a healthcare perspective. They see a guy threatening to open up the economy, whether it's, you know, in time. And then they're looking at their investments and they're seeing their investments shrinking. So that's a trifecta of failure for the elderly.
It is. It is. And the other thing that's interesting, and I just saw another great little study, voting by mail, probably just as many Republicans and conservatives vote by mail as liberals and Democrats. Mm-hmm. So when you say, oh, you know, voter fraud and voting by mail, you may be actually, if you're a Republican, cutting off your own nose. Because in Iowa, our Republican Secretary of State, and that's true of, I think, six Republican Secretaries of State, they're saying, we're going to vote by mail. We're not going to make people go to polling places. We're going to save a lot of money by closing polling places. And that money can be used to send people their ballots and they can vote by mail.
Exactly. So we have to talk about Pompeo, because the story of Pompeo is not the story of Pompeo. It's the story of another fired IG. It's the story of, you know, Pompeo basically going to the president saying, get rid of this IG, and then claiming that he didn't know that he was being investigated.
Right.
Gag me with
this. Oh, sure.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. And then we find out that he's holding all these fancy schmancy dinners last year in anticipation of maybe running for the United States Senate, maybe running for president in God knows when. And these fancy dinners, this is like unbelievable. One of the people that was on the list that NBC News reported that was invited to this fancy dinner was my governor.
Wow.
Now, let me think about this. Why would Chris Sununu be invited to a fancy schmancy dinner for Pompeo? What does this have to do with the Secretary of State's office? What does this have to do with anything? In fact, Mrs. Pompeo, who has an office, by the way, in the State Department, her own office and her own staff, although she's not on the payroll, basically when she had Chris Sununu's name on the list, she said, make sure you get him there ASAP. And what do we know about Chris Sununu? It's a Republican governor in a state that does the first in the nation primary.
Whoa. But also, though, you have a lot of foreign policy relations with Canada.
Oh,
New Hampshire and Canada. So Pompeo is very concerned about that lonely border up there with Canada, and that's why he wanted to make sure that he had the New Hampshire governor. Now, I don't know if our governor got invited to one of those or not. I'm going to try to find that out.
She should be insulted if she wasn't invited. I mean, our governor was.
Well, he knows that the Iowa caucuses are dead, so Iowa isn't going to be first in the nation anymore.
That's true. That's absolutely true. Stefan Schmidt is known as Dr. Politics, and he resides in Iowa. He is a fabulous political science professor. Ciao. This is the first edition of The Attitude. Talk to you on Monday. You bet.